National Broadcasting Company presents The National Hour. This is a mirror of public opinion, reflecting what America and the world are thinking, planning, doing. This is today's interpretation of the problems and the newsworthy milestones that we must reach and pass on the road to peace and reconstruction. Today, February 24th, 1946, we present the 15th in the distinguished new NBC series, The National Hour. Our subject for today...
The Railroads of America.
First-class passage from New York to Los Angeles by train, $145.
The same trip by air, $136.
Time by train, 2.5 days.
Time by airplane, 10 to 14 hours.
This is Robert St. John in New York. We are concerned today with the railroads of America and the threat they face from the high-powered competition of the airplane. Will air travel seriously affect the future of railroading? Will it change the emphasis in rail travel from passenger to freight? What new problems are brought into focus by this competition? In what way are the railroads preparing to meet the future? These, then, are some of the questions raised by the National Hour today. And to give you a concrete demonstration of the trend in present-day railroad thinking, we hope to hear a shortwave radio pickup from a modern streamlined train, the world's only vista-domed railway car, which at this moment is rolling across the state of Illinois.
This is Robert McCormick in Washington. Like a great many other good things, the railways have suffered the fate of being taken for granted. We sometimes forget that for 116 years, men have struggled to create and maintain them. New ways to travel have caught the public fancy and the public watches, but the railroads are acting. Later in the program, Mr. Charles H. Buford, operating vice president of the Association of American Railroads, will tell us of the railroad's post-war plan. You will also hear from Mr. Warren C. Kendall, chief of the association's car loading division, who manipulated the nation's freight cars all during the war.
Yes, the airplane is the most dangerous threat standing over the railroads today. It's a double-barreled threat. For airplanes not only carry passengers, they also transport freight. And from freight, the railroads derive most of their income. In an average year, 80% of their income derives from freight. Freight is their lifeblood. It's always been so since railways began, even as far back as 1827. In that year, a few of Baltimore's hard-headed citizens got together to discuss the matter.
You'll get none of my money.
You'll find no better way to invest a dollar, Mr. O'Gorman, than in building a railroad.
I still say, Mr. Chairman, give me a cart and a husky team to pull it, and I'll get you all the flour we need from West Virginia.
Gentlemen, that's what we've been doing. And look at the prices. They pay a dollar a barrel in wheeling, but it costs five the time it gets here. Why, most of that $4 we pay for hauling is thrown away.
You're absolutely right. You think your newfangled railroad could do it for less?
Yes, of course. We could haul it by rail for 90 cents a barrel.
90 cents a barrel.
And that's not all. Every car could carry 12 barrels.
That's a lot of poppycock.
Well, gentlemen, 10 anyhow. And our engine could haul at least 4 cars. Why, this railroad would bring the commerce of the whole Ohio Valley right into our laps.
Well, I say, let's take a chance and try it.
All right, then, let's go. Well,
let's get her rolling.
Well, what are you going to call this railroad?
We'll call her the Baltimore and Ohio. Yeah.
To Today, a steel web, 227,000 miles of it, covers the forests and the plains of America. Over the years, the railways have carried our commerce, building a nation, growing strong themselves. Until today, our railroad freight costs are just about the lowest anywhere in the world. Here in America, it costs less than 1 cent to haul 1 ton of freight 1 mile by rail. In sharp contrast, the airlines charge about 40 to 50 cents to fly a ton the same distance.
You mean to stand there and tell me that you paid $2 for this pineapple?
But gee, it's well worth it, Dad. Think of having tree-ripened fruit right from the tropics by plane.
At double the price. That's no trick, boy.
Oh, Dad, you're always thinking about money.
And as long as you're always thinking about your stomach, I've got to be.
A businessman like you ought to have more vision. Why, our prof said yesterday that this air freight service is a boon to our culture.
And a bang at my pocketbook.
Oh, applesauce. In time, everything will go by plane. We're living in the air age, Dad. Haven't you heard?
Well, that's one individual's idea, and it may be a fair one as far as the transport of tropical fruits is concerned. But bringing ripe dates from Smyrna in time for lunch has little or no relation to the national freight picture. Here is what one railroad executive has to say on the question of air freight versus train freight.
We concede that much of the first-class mail, a good deal of express and some freight on the larger hauls, and the longer ones will be carried by plane. But the bulk of heavy goods, coal, lumber, machinery, can by its very nature be transported only by rail.
No, the iron horse is definitely not a dead horse. Years of hauling the commerce of America have toughened him, and certainly no weakling, no industry on its last legs could possibly have turned in so impressive a performance as did the railroads during the war. Here are the facts from official records. With 24% fewer freight cars, the railroads carried 67% more freight in this war than they did in the last. And they did it with far fewer employees. How did they do it? Higher speeds and larger cars are part of the answer. But there was another important factor, something Americans have taken to calling know-how.
Here with me in our New York studio is Mr. Warren C. Kendall from the Office of Defense Transportation. Just what is freight car know-how, Mr. Kendall?
Mr. St. John has asked me about freight car know-how. There are a great many thousands of men in the United States who know the answer, and not all of them by any means are railroad men. A lot of them are the traffic managers and staffs of those who ship and receive freight. Men from the Interstate Commerce Commission, the Office of Defense Transportation, and the Armed Services. The freight car know-how which they and the railroad men have is just this: to work together to get freight cars loaded promptly and loaded fully, to get them unloaded promptly and completely, to get them moving promptly, and to keep them rolling. That's one of the main reasons why the average freight train today is turning out 2.5 times as much transportation per hour as it did 25 years ago. There is still a most difficult transportation task ahead. The demand for high-grade boxcars, suitable for loading such things as grain and flour, is heavier now than it was during the war. That's due, in large part, to the extreme urgency of moving the grain which the United States government is sending abroad to help feed less fortunate peoples. The demand for refrigerator cars to handle perishable products is above wartime levels. And the supply of both high-grade boxcars and refrigerator cars has been reduced through the wear and tear of the war years. Another obstacle is the general adoption of the shorter work week in industry, leaving only 5 days for loading and unloading cars. But the men with the freight car know-how are still working together, both to get the most service out of the cars we have and to design still better cars for the future. The car lines and the agricultural shipping interests are cooperating in an extended research to improve refrigerator cars. And to pull the cars, there will be new types of locomotives running on better tracks, guided by better signals, all as part of the great machine which moves the vast bulk of America's freight.
Thank you, Mr. Kendall. We can be certain that competition between rail and air will not focus on the question of freight. The airlines expect to get little of that anyway. Primary interest seems to center in the person of an innocent bystander. Call him John Doe, traveler. Mr. Doe will be offered everything by the airlines: speed, free meals, prestige. And by the railroads, he'll be offered luxury at moderate cost. Yes, he will be wooed as no beloved ever was before. In this suit, the aeroplane, being a glamour girl, has the edge. She has stimulated the public's imagination to the point, well, to the point where even Buck Rogers is beginning to look a little tame.
Oh, wasn't that an exciting trip, son? You know, the last time we came back from Mars, the pilot didn't go anywhere near the moon.
Oh, yeah.
What's the matter, son? Another stratosphere headache.
Oh, now, what's there to get all head up about?
Oh, you're just an old wet blanket.
Oh, listen, Ma, when I was a kid, back in 1985, didn't Pop used to take us to Mars every weekend and in our own spaceship? Those were the days. It took 10 hours then. A guy could really enjoy the scenery.
Oh, stop bragging about your father's spaceship. I wouldn't be caught dead in it. I want one of those new transparent steel strato roadsters, like Mrs. Brown.
Oh, Ma, that's all you ever think about, transparent steel.
But they're so light and sunny. Well, you can see right through them. Mrs. Brown took me round the Earth in hers one afternoon last week, and it was marvelous.
Oh, yeah, but they take a lot of fuel.
They do not. Atomic energy is very cheap. Why, we took a run out the Milky Way last weekend. I only used a thimbleful of root beer.
Oh, so that's what you've been doing.
Oh, look, there's Mrs. Brown now. She's flying over to Venus this afternoon. Let's go along, eh?
Okay.
Mrs. Brown, you! Oh, wait for us. Oh, dear. I hope we get to Venus in time for dinner.
Yes, hey, we can order some of those swell love apples.
Yes, that's one picture of the air future. But those wispy dreams of spaceships, all the comic strip stuff, have to take a back seat when the facts and figures enter. Now, here's a more practical view. An airline officer speaks.
Air passenger fares will continue downward to about 2.5 cents a mile. Flight schedules will increase in both frequency and scope. Freight costs will stabilize for a while at 15 cents a ton mile, then move slowly downward. Such rates will definitely cut into the revenues of other common carriers.
How much they will cut into railroad revenues is another matter. The railroads met a similar storm once before, and they weathered it. When buses on the highways first started to haul passengers across the country, it was thought that all of their business was taken from the railroads. However, investigations proved that out of every 100 passengers, only 10 had preferred the bus to the railroad. The remaining 90 were actually created passengers. In other words, the bulk of bus travelers were not potential railroad passengers at all. The low fares simply encouraged these people to take trips by bus they would not otherwise have made.
Well, in another way, that may hold true for the airplane. If you want to go to the Pacific coast but have only 2 days to spare, you go by plane or you don't go at all. Your trip would bring business to the airline without taking it from the railroad, just as simple as that.
During the war, due to stepped-up schedules and continuous use, railroad cars wore out faster than ever. None could be built to replace them. To make things worse, more people rode the trains than ever before. Something had to give way, and it was usually some passenger's temper. The railroads, fighting shortages all along the line, had to face some bitter complaints.
I paid good money for a seat, and then I had to stand all the way to Philly.
My car was like the North Pole, darn near froze.
I didn't ask for horse meat, waiter. I want a steak.
Mommy, that man stepped on my dolly.
But I've simply got to get to Florida. If you don't give me a reservation, I'll report you.
This car must have come over on the Mayflower.
Yes, complaints were many and audible, but with only 2/3 as many engines and cars, the railroads during this war carried twice the number of passengers they did in the last war. And that includes the transport of 97% of our armed forces. And the average serviceman traveled 1,100 miles during his career with Uncle Sam.
And in spite of the fact that they were born of wartime conditions, those complaints bothered the railroads. They were planning to build thousands of new cars after the war, and naturally they wanted people to like them. So the railroads went directly to the public for advice. Mr. and Mrs. Public were both asked what they wanted in post-war trains, and they answered,
"More air conditioning. That's what we need.
I'd like an adjustable seat and individual lights you can turn off if you want to go to sleep."
"Yeah, and they should reserve all coach seats. I want to be sure I have a place to sit when I get on a train."
"Tobacco smoke, it shouldn't be allowed except in smokers."
"I'd like a nice big sand pile and some toys, somewhere to play."
"Why can't they have curtains you could pull out between seats? Give you more privacy."
"And cheaper fares."
One man had a few special requests.
"I want a seat with plenty of legroom, wider windows, radio, clock, speedometer, and free newspaper."
"Is that all?"
"I want a companion furnished by the railroad."
"What's that again?"
"A companion, a blonde."
"And the railroads say you'll get most of those things. Of course, you will have to bring your own blonde. But $1 billion will be spent this year on improvements and new equipment. And here is a glance at what's ahead."
Railroad previews of 1946.
A three-tier sleeper designed for the limited budget. It gives sleeping accommodations for approximately the present cost of coach travel. The aisle runs along one side of the car. Individual seats, three in a row, replace the familiar seats in pairs. At night, the seats are converted into tiers of three berths.
The roomette, a small private room costing about the same as today's lower berth. It will have a contour seat, table, washing facilities, and a ready-made bed concealed in the wall.
A three-deck commuter coach featuring a roomy upper deck covered by a curved glass dome. It can be used as a solarium, a dining room, or a passenger section. The two lower decks will be used for seating accommodation, game section, and storage.
And the day-night coach. It has adjustable seats suitable for sleepers, curtains for privacy, individual lighting, and is geared to suit the thrifty traveler.
The recreation car. By day, an observation lounge. By night, half of it becomes a movie hall seating 30 people. The other half, a nightclub with a small dance floor.
"Oh, look, Mommy. They even got a junior club car for children. Slides, games, toys, books, Punch and Judy shows. They got everything."
Yes, time changes all things, and trains will even look different. Subdued colors and tasteful decorations on the inside, gleaming stainless steel on the outside. Colors and decor that reflect the character of the countryside through which the cars pass. Trains serving the New England coast, for example, will draw their motifs and color schemes from the sea, while the interior fittings of trains serving the Southwest will be based on the art of the Indians.
Most of the improvements we've talked about are still in the blueprint stage, but now it's time to demonstrate one that's kissing the rails this very moment. Right now, speeding through Illinois, the futuristic Vista Dome of the Burlington Railroad is giving its passengers a taste of tomorrow's travel. At this moment, as the Vista Dome flyer streaks through western Illinois on her way to Lincoln, NBC's Bob Brown is talking to passengers in the sun-flooded dome above the car. In a moment, you will hear our first broadcast from the Burlington's Vista Dome car. Come in, Bob Brown.
"I'm speaking to you from the Vista Dome of the Burlington crack train, the Advance Flyer, which just a few moments ago passed through the prosperous middle western city of Galesburg, Illinois. And you've heard the Vista Dome described, and I know that everyone in this car agrees that it offers a breathtaking means of train travel for the post-war era. In fact, as I look through the tinted glass of the Vista Dome at the Illinois countryside to which we're passing, it seems as if we are sitting motionless in a glass bubble while the landscape itself moves toward us, smoothly, effortlessly. Farms and forests and towns coming up over the horizon ahead, marching to meet us, surrounding us, and then silently falling behind us. It's a wonderful sensation. At the moment, on my right, we're just passing a fine farm. All the buildings are painted white. They have green roofs. On the left, another prosperous-looking farm. Large herd of cattle out there in the barnyard. On the left, a highway running parallel to the tracks. Quite a bit of traffic for Sunday afternoon. In fact, it's a wonderful sensation to be riding here in this Vista Dome, and I think it's high time that we see how some of the passengers are enjoying their ride in the Vista Dome. On my left, there's a very charming lady. I wonder if she'll tell me her name.
Mrs. Catherine Bartlett.
Mrs. Bartlett, where are you from?
From Illinois.
And you're bound for there now?
Yes.
And just what is your sensation in riding in this new style of transportation?
It's the most delightful trip I've ever made, Mr. Father.
Well, thank you very much, Mrs. Barcliff. And behind Mrs. Barcliff are two gentlemen in naval uniform. I'm going to ask this chap his name.
Bill Callahan.
What's your rank, Bill?
I'm an ensign.
Who's your friend?
Frank Lawman.
Where are you coming from?
I was just coming from the Great Lakes.
And where are you bound for?
I'm taking Frank home, I think, for a few days at home.
Wonderful idea. And how do you both like the Vista Dome?
It's wonderful.
Well, that's good. I'm glad to hear that. Thank you very, very much. So, ladies and gentlemen, our brief visit is ended, but we hope that you, too, someday will have the experience, the delightful thrill of traveling in the Burlington's Vista Dome. Now, this is Bob Brown, switching you back to the National Hour in New York.
This is Robert St. John in New York again. Before many more months pass, more trains featuring glass-domed upper decks will be in service on other railroads. Some of them will even service Solarium.
Baloney!
Yes, baloney!
Well, well, do I hear other dissenting voices?
No, Mr. St. John, but my father says he's getting sick of all this skittle-scattle about streamlined trains.
Yes, skittle-scattle.
And who is your father?
He's the man who runs the thing that pulls them.
He's pretty tired of taking a back seat, too.
How about throwing a little bit of the spotlight on what drives those new cars?
Oh, so your father's an engineer.
Yes, sir. He runs a diesel electric locomotive.
What's that?
Well, a diesel's an internal combustion engine that burns a special oil.
Oil? Well, then where does the electric come in?
It doesn't come in. It goes out.
The diesel drives a generator that makes electricity.
Oh, yes, I remember. Then the electricity runs a motor and
that drives the locomotive.
Yeah, simple, huh?
Well,
And what a sweet job. 2,000 horsepower in every unit. And every unit like a mother's kiss.
Yes, the railroads are modernizing up front and back in the cars. But it's a fight against time, and meanwhile, airplanes hurtling through space capture the imagination. And air travel is another real ace in the hole, speed. As speed goes up, rates seem to tumble. The present airfare is 4.5 cents a mile, already comparable to first-class rail rates, may soon be lowered. If it is, the air lanes will have drawn first blood in the battle now shaping up. Both camps are tense, and neither side is talking. But among the interested citizenry, there is plenty of talk.
Well, you can say what you like, but to me, traveling on a train's murder. What I want is speed.
Speed, that's all you harp on. That ain't everything. Suppose there's a storm raging somewhere. Where's your airplane then?
Well, a storm don't last forever, you know.
And neither does a man's patience.
Oh, now look, Bob, an airplane trip costs about the same as first class on a train.
Nobody's arguing about that. But a train's got comfort. You can walk around, get the kinks out of your leg.
Yeah, well, look what you can see from an airplane. The whole works. Not just a lot of shacks alongside a track.
Yeah. Once I was up. Dumbest trip I ever took in my life. All I saw was clouds.
This is Robert McCormick again from Washington. Yes, the conflict has captured the public's imagination. For after all, the railroads opened up and developed the West, and many authorities will tell you that the railroads, more than anything else, have held this country together as a political entity. And now they look to the future. With me here in the studio is a man who knows the railroad picture intimately. He's Mr. Charles H. Buford, operating vice president of the Association of American Railroads. Well, Mr. Buford, what can the railroads do about this situation, if anything?
Mr. McCormick's remarks raise a question as to whether there is a future for the railroads. There most assuredly is if there is a future for this country. For when there is a big job of hauling to be done in America, there is nothing that can take the place of trains of cars running on tracks. Mr. Kendall told you a little while ago about some of the freight prospects on the railroads. Of course, that's the big end of the railroad business. And mighty important it is in the daily lives of every one of us in this country. But everyone is a potential passenger, too. And the railroads have got something to offer them in the way of roominess and comfort, safety and reliability. A lot of people have made their first acquaintance with railroad passenger service during the war years, when no new cars could be built, and when travel on the trains had quadrupled. The railroads have been acutely conscious of the fact that much of their wartime passenger service was below normal standards. They had a job to do, however, a job that no one else could even attempt, and they did it the best they could with what they had. The first passenger car built since the war was delivered and put in service last week. It is the forerunner of a couple of thousand such cars, the equivalent of about 200 trains, that will go into service in the next 12 months or so. Almost as many new cars as were built during the 10 years just before the war. Enough of them should be in service this summer, it is hoped, to enable the railroads to take reasonably good care of this year's vacation travel. And by next year and the years after that, the railroads will have whole fleets of new trains at the service of those 140 million potential passengers.
Thank you, Mr. Buford.
Railways of America has been the subject of our documentary, and this is what we have learned.
That the nation's airlines today are concentrating upon winning away a sizable portion of railroad passengers. That airlines will cut deeper into this passenger traffic than into freight. That the railroads are now in their best financial shape in years. That they'll fight this competition with new streamlined trains, incorporating every technical advance made during the war years. The railroads, unable to compete in the realm of speed, will make up for it with more luxurious accommodations available to more travelers.
On the subject of the American railways, then, our documentary is closed.
Except for a final word about a very important railroad man.
This here's your station, sir.
No, huh? What?
Time to get off, sir.
Oh, thanks, George. I must have been asleep. Oh, you got my bag?
Yes, sir, I got both of them.
Well, come on, let's go then. Say, George, you know what I heard about you porters?
No, sir.
Well, the railroads ask a lot of passengers what they like best, porters or hostesses. You know what they said?
Uh-oh. What did they say?
They said one of the things they didn't want changed on the railroad was you porters.
Doggone, you know, there sure must be some mistake there.
No, sir, George. You're the man they've chosen for the streamlined train of the future.
Well, maybe so, but I'm going to tell you one thing, sir. They ain't never going to streamline me.
And now this is Robert St. John inviting you to be with us again next Sunday at the same time when our subject will be A Design for Streamlining Congress.
This has been the National Hour. From our studios in New York and Washington, and by short wave from atop the Vista Dome, the National Broadcasting Company has presented the 15th in the distinguished new series on national problems and current affairs. Our speakers today were Warren C. Kendall and Charles H. Buford, replacing John J. Pelley, who was unable to appear today. Robert St. John was your narrator, with Robert McCormick reporting from Washington. NBC, the National Broadcasting Company. Mm-hmm.